Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
Good evening, everyone. If you enjoy our show and find our research both interesting and informative, please can I ask that you consider leaving us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform. Something that small really does help us out a huge amount. You can also find out more about us and our work by heading over to deadsouls.co.uk and checking us out. We are a small team of 3 researchers with more than 70 years of experience between us. You can also find us and speak to us over on Instagram. Just search Dead Souls Social Club and we'll come up. So, as always, thank you so much for joining us tonight. This audio presentation contains graphic details of death, violence, and controversial subject matter. Listener discretion is strongly advised. From Dead Souls Media, this is Life After Death. I'm Jamie Black, a researcher and psychologist, and I'll be your host for tonight. Picture this for a moment. You slowly wake up. As your sleepiness fades and your eyes open, you come face to face with a bright white light. The light feels inviting. It's warm and it draws you in. It feels kind of the same way as home. You can feel love and longing in the light. As you sit up and stare into the light, your life flashes before your eyes. It's like a scene from a movie. Everything you remember doing and the things that you don't recall, it all ties together nicely and everything just makes sense. You see things as the bigger picture. You've lost all stresses, worries, and concerns. For the first time since you can remember, you are at peace. Then the memory of your life starts to fade, just like waking from a dream. You hear a really familiar voice, someone that you love and care about, trust, and really want to speak to. Their voice welcomes you and says that they're happy that you are there. They have missed you. It feels amazing. You feel amazing. But the voice gently tells you that you can't stay. The voice says that whilst they need you and want you more than anything, they will see you again when the time is right. All of a sudden, a burst of red-hot pain sears through your chest, like hot lava running through your lungs and veins. It feels like every single cell in your body is on fire. You can't breathe. The air is thin, and you can't draw in any breath. You hear a scream. The scream is awful. It sends shivers down your spine. It's blood-curdling. Then you realize the scream is you. That sound is coming from you. You're in a hospital bed surrounded by doctors and nurses. They all take a step back, stunned. They're staring at you. What the hell is going on? You think to yourself. Well, it's because you've just come back from the dead. Tonight on Dead Souls, we are going to get metaphysical. Strap in. A few things for housekeeping's sake. We are not a religious podcast. Hell, we here at Dead Souls are not even religious at all. So while we may touch on religious beliefs in this episode, it's from a place of balance and cultural journalism. We'll also present the science, which sits on the other side of the scale. Now, did you know that all known Earth cultures have an ancient flood myth? No matter whether it's a religious story like Noah's Ark and the Great Flood, from the book of Genesis in the Christian Old Testament, or a cultural myth like the Choctaw Native American flood story. The flood myth motif occurs the world over. The Manvantara Sandhya in Hinduism, Deucalion and Pyrrha in Greek mythology, and Mesopotamian flood stories, and so on and so on. Since every culture has a flood myth, many scientists and historians today no longer think this is just a story. The flood myth was very likely an actual historical event, an event that was so significant that it was handed down by tribes and peoples all over the world into religions and cultures that we know today. And just like the great flood myth, every religion and culture on Earth also has a story of the afterlife. And the more consistent the story, well, are we to believe that there is more likelihood of that myth or story being true if measured by the same standards? Because most religions and cultures will attach a social aspect to the afterlife. For example, the ancient Egyptians believed in Aru, the field of reeds. Aru is an idealized vision of one's own life on Earth, known as Sekhet Aru, translated directly as the field of rushes. Death was not the end of life in ancient Egypt, but a transition to another part of one's eternal journey. The ancient Egyptians saw Aru as the perfect world, an image of how we live on Earth. Here, your soul is granted eternal paradise, but only if you pass the transitional test. When your soul first leaves your body, Anubis appears beside you. He then guides you from your tomb to wait in the line of souls. In this line, you would be comforted and given food and water by deities. As the line gets shorter, and when it's your turn, you are led to the Hall of Truth. This is where Osiris, Thoth, and Maat weighed your heart on the scales of justice. If your soul was virtuous, your heart would be very light. It would need to be, because it is weighed against the feather of Maat, the winged goddess of truth and justice. If, however, your heart was heavy, weighed down with guilt and negative burden, you would be deemed unworthy of paradise. Your heart would therefore be heavier than the feather of Maat. If this happened, then Amut, a part lion, crocodile, hippopotamus, horrific monster, would then eat your heart. And if your soul was virtuous, then you would be free to enter the reeds of Aru, where you would find eternal paradise. If this story of judgment, journey, and paradise sounds familiar, it's because the same story in varying formats and degrees is told in almost all major religions. While you await judgment, there's usually a holding area. For Catholics, it's referred to as purgatory. In Islam, this is called Barzakh. Inuits and some Native American tribes describe a long road, which they refer to as the Milky Way. In ancient Greece, before your soul reaches the underworld, be it Elysium, the Asphodel fields, or Tartarus if you weren't so lucky, you had to cross the river Styx. When we have passed through the holding area, our souls are judged based on how we lived our life here on Earth. With the help of deities like Saint Peter, we experience a sort of life review. If we have lived good lives, we are gifted or rewarded with a pleasurable and happy afterlife. If we have lived poorly or outside the boundaries of what are considered religious or cultural acceptable norms, then we are sent to hell or the bad place, where we either must learn from our mistakes or suffer for all eternity. I'm sure you all know this story from when you were a kid. But not every religion works this way. In Buddhism, for example, souls are reincarnated over and over again. In all actuality, reincarnation is a central tenet of several religions, many in Indian origin, such as Hinduism, Jainism, and Sikhism. But not exclusively. It also occurs as an esoteric belief in many streams of Judaism, in certain pagan religions, such as Wicca, and in some beliefs of the indigenous peoples of the Americas and of Aboriginal Australians. Some ancient Greek historical figures, such as Pythagoras, Socrates, and Plato, also expressed belief in the soul's rebirth or transmigration. Live a good life, and in the next one you'll be rewarded with a better life. Live a bad life, and your next life will be more difficult or challenging. Some religions state that once you live a life free from desire, attachment, and ignorance, and if you follow a life which follows the teaching of said religion, then you can escape the cycle of reincarnation and reach nirvana. Most atheists will tell you, of course, that there is nothing after death, just the bleak, black void. Many find this thought or belief extremely challenging and hard to accept, however. But most people will say they feel that there is something more, something waiting for us on the other side, although they aren't sure what that is. In fact, a recent poll in 2017 revealed that 83% of American adults believe in some kind of afterlife. That number is 33% for the British, who are significantly less religious. 60% of Canadians believe in the afterlife, 30% of Australians, 38% of Germans, and roughly 30% of the Japanese. And, you know, for most of all human history, there was no way to prove the existence of an afterlife one way or the other. We'd have to bring someone back from the dead to do that, and death is final, right? Well, this is why religion is solely based on belief and faith. But is this still the case? Is death still final? Well, let's look at some of the science. In 1943, a young army recruit named George G. Ritchie caught pneumonia while based in Texas. He passed out while on duty. He was placed by base medics in an isolation room. When an attendant checked on him 24 hours later, he found that Ritchie had no pulse, nor was he breathing. George had died. He was just 20 years old. A medical officer pronounced him dead and pulled a sheet over his face. George's death could have been avoided, the medical staff at the site thought. They were concerned there might be repercussions or accusations of neglect. The same medical officer, after checking breathing, pulse, and heartbeat, gave orders for his body to be taken to the base morgue. But when the attendant came back around 10 minutes later, he thought he saw chest movement coming from under the sheet that they had placed over Ritchie's body. Even though Ritchie's vital signs were still showing as negative, the attendant convinced the medical officer to give him a shot of adrenaline. Ritchie's pulse returned, and he started breathing again. But after the adrenaline shot, George woke up with a startle. He sat immediately upright and got to his feet. Sure, he was drowsy, but he felt fully recovered from pneumonia. In fact, he felt great. The only thing on his mind was returning to Virginia to finish his army medical training. While George was on his way back to Virginia, he stopped at a small town called Vicksburg in Mississippi to ask for directions. But everyone he spoke to just ignored him, like he wasn't there. At the back of his mind, he also had a ringing in his head. No, wait. It was a distant beeping. Over and over again. It grew closer while he was walking around the town, and gradually he could hear it up close, directly in his ear. It wasn't there earlier when he set off on his journey. But wait a second. How did he start his journey again? His memory was fuzzy, hazy even. Had he flown? No, wait. Was he driving? He couldn't remember. And that beeping was getting louder and louder and louder, until he couldn't ignore it anymore. It sounded like medical equipment. You see, George was training to be an army doctor, and he knew the sound was from a heart monitor. It was his heart monitor. When George eventually woke up, 4 days later, he realized that he had never left the hospital, at least not physically. He was laying in the same bed that he had died in 4 days earlier. The adrenaline kick that started his heart and breathing again hadn't immediately awoken him like he thought. Even though George was officially dead for quite some time, almost 20 minutes in fact, he eventually made a full recovery, and in an interesting side note, George had never been to Vicksburg in Mississippi in his entire life. But after he left the hospital, around 10 months later, Ritchie happened to travel through Vicksburg in Mississippi and saw the exact place that he had seen during the experience. He recognized shops, streets, buildings, and knew exactly where things were. But he had never physically been there. He also recognized a garage attendant whom he had approached for directions, but had ignored him. In 1965, George Ritchie told his story to a class of his postgraduate psychiatry students. One of those students was a man named Raymond Moody. Moody was so fascinated by George's experience that he dedicated the rest of his career to figuring out what happens on the other side of death. Here's Moody.
I don't mind saying that after talking with over 1,000 people who have had these experiences and having experienced many times some of the really baffling and unusual features of these experiences, it has given me great confidence that there is a life after death. As a matter of fact, I must confess to you, in all honesty, I have absolutely no doubt, on the basis of what my patients have told me, that they did get a glimpse of the beyond.
Moody called this phenomenon a, quote, near-death experience, or NDE. He coined the term in his 1975 book titled Life After Life. It's where we get the phrase or terminology in today's vernacular from. Moody's work inspired many, many others to collect massive amounts of data on people who technically died but were revived. One of these researchers is Dr. Michael Sabum, who has written several books on NDEs. One of those books is 1998's Light and Death, one doctor's fascinating account of near-death experiences. In the book, Sabum presented interviews with 116 people who had experienced a near-death crisis, which he discusses and classifies. Sabum's research is where things start to get interesting. In his research, Sabum interviewed people who had suffered cardiac arrest, had died, and claimed to have had an out-of-body experience, or NDE. These patients were asked to describe their resuscitation, what was happening in the room, who was there, what sounds did they recall hearing, and so on. The patients' answers were compared to those of a control group who had also suffered cardiac crisis and were revived but without temporary death. Patients in the control group reported back with vague, mostly inconsistent and incorrect answers. Specifically, 83% of control group respondents gave incorrect information. They were essentially guessing what had happened to them, for the most part. They didn't really know what had happened. But the NDE group, well, this is interesting, in their responses, they described the resuscitations almost perfectly, like they had been in the room, separate from their bodies, watching themselves come back to life. 89% of the respondents, in fact, were accurate in their accounts of what they saw. Respondents who had been brought in unconscious and could have had no realistic memory of the room. The accuracy was enough for Dr. Sabum to conduct further research and studies. And like Raymond Moody, Sabum inspired others to repeat his research. If multiple researchers independently conduct similar or exactly the same experiment, and they all find the same results, then it's hard to refute the truth. Peer review and experimentation and results duplication is what makes up scientifically evidenced phenomenon. This is precisely what happened with Dr. Sabum's study. In the decades since the 1970s, when Sabum pioneered his work, researchers have asked thousands of patients to describe events and specifics surrounding their NDEs, and despite them being biologically dead, these patients are between 92 to 97% accurate in their observations. This is an overwhelming accuracy margin. A significant amount of doctors and nurses have also come forward with some pretty spooky stories in support of this research. Dr. Carl Green, a neurosurgeon at the Barrow Neurological Institute in Phoenix, Arizona, is one of these doctors. Green had a patient named Pam Reynolds, who flatlined and then described her entire surgery down to the most intricate detail. Reynolds described medical instruments used, comments and discussions the surgeons had, and even the color and style of the assistant nurse's glasses frames. But Green is not alone. Patients have often had out-of-body experiences during surgeries when they temporarily die and have a very clear and concise experience that they are able to prove with detail they are otherwise not privy to. In fact, I have a personal story of my own to share. This happened to a friend of my grandfather's. As you guys know by now, I grew up with my grandfather, who made a career from psychology, and one of his passions specifically was parapsychology. He investigated and researched spooky stuff, essentially, and he did it at a time when that wasn't cool or mainstream in the slightest. With that, he met and became close friends with all kinds of interesting people who had all kinds of interesting experiences. One of those people was named Colin Weir. He was just a regular gentleman from Liverpool in the UK. He was married with two children and worked as an electrician. He liked sports, particularly football and rugby, and also served as a British soldier during the Falklands War. Other than those things, there was nothing particularly unique about Colin. Entirely his words, he'd say as much himself. He was incredibly warm, kind and family-focused. He became friends with my grandfather way, way before I was born. They had already known each other for about 15 years when I first met him as a kid. Anyway, Colin. Colin got into a car crash in January 1993. He was on his way home from work and the roads were pretty bad. Icy. Certainly not the best driving conditions. A teenage girl had tried to overtake a bus. She was a new driver, only 17. She hit Colin head on. She was on the wrong side of the road, and Colin was in, well, the wrong place at the wrong time, I guess. Colin lost a leg in the accident. He also spent 2 weeks in a coma. The young girl sadly lost her life in the crash. Where am I going with all this? Well, Colin was airlifted from the scene and effectively died in the helicopter. The hospital had been advised ahead of time that the patient would be deceased upon arrival. But at the hospital, doctors defibrillated Colin and brought him back against significant odds. He had lost so much blood, they didn't think he would make it to the hospital. But he did, barely. But Colin flatlined again during surgery on his leg. But it was what Colin told my grandfather afterwards that was the most astonishing part. Colin said at the time of his death, he felt weightless while he was unconscious. He stated that he was watching his operation. He was in the room, but looking at his body in the third person. He was stood in the room watching the doctors work on his body, though he was watching as if someone else. He said he felt extreme calm and inner peace at the time, and no anxiety or panic as he looked on. But then Colin said he felt a pull, a sort of strange urge to walk back out of the room, like it was important for him to do so. He turned and saw his mother standing in the doorway. His mother, who had been gone a long time, deceased some 20 years prior. Colin said to his mother that he was in a lot of pain, that he was tired and needed to rest. "I can't do it," he said. She said to him, "Yes, you can. It's not your time just yet. I love you, but I'll always be waiting for you when the time is right." They got Colin's heart started again and brought him back. In total, Colin was dead for around 10 minutes in the helicopter and around 12 minutes at the hospital. He said the experience was just as real to him as real life, not a dream-like experience. Colin recounted this story many times over the years, to my grandfather and others that I had seen him speak to. His story was always consistent. What made his account so captivating, though, was that he could recall exact conversations that the doctors and assistant nurses had in the operating room. What procedures were carried out, the shoes the doctors were wearing, and items that were in the operating theatre. He could also recall the name of the helicopter pilot that transported his lifeless body to the hospital, and posters on the wall of the operating room and rooms outside. He was entirely accurate, and two doctors and a nurse corroborated everything that he recalled. It was fascinating. Colin was a very truthful, honest, and decent man. He eventually passed in 2003. Sometimes people do more than just float a few feet above their bodies or stand by their own side. Some people have described events that took place down the hall from their deathbed, or, as such in Colin's case, in a different room in the hospital. So not only do our souls have weight, they stick around to watch our physical bodies die in some accounts. And we don't just stay in the room, we wander. And while we wander, we are not alone, it seems. Almost all near-death experiences follow a similar pattern. It starts with a sensation of absolute peace and calm as you enter a bright white light. Through the light, you enter a tunnel and your physical body is left behind. Most people witness their death in the third person, and the experience is never traumatic. In 1791, British Naval Admiral Sir Francis Beaufort almost drowned. After he was revived, he described a feeling as encountering the most perfect, wonderful tranquility. His words. He felt no pain. His physical senses had gone. But his mind, his consciousness, if you like, was very much active. The Admiral saw his life pass before his eyes, but in reverse. This is another common theme in NDEs. Your life playing either in reverse chronological order or starting from your birth until your death. Like a movie, I suppose, recounting all the key points. Once the show is over, you see yourself as a whole, and really for the first time ever a complete lifetime, a full account. Then, well, you move on to the other side where people are waiting for you. Professor Malcolm Nellis drowned while he was canoeing in Spain. He was dead for 30 minutes, and long enough for his body to have turned completely blue before being pulled from the water. There were no vital signs. No breathing, no heartbeat, and no pulse. Professor Malcolm Nellis.
And then I was released to the heavens. My spirit rose up and out of the river, and I was immediately greeted by a group of people or spirits who had known me and loved me as long as I have existed. I was amongst family, friends, and other living people. But this was not a religious experience. This was real, human, and natural.
Seeing people on the other side is almost always a positive experience. Minister Don Piper was driving home to Alvin in Texas one night and was hit by an 18-wheeler in a head-on collision. The crash was horrific. In fact, his body was weaved into the wreckage of metal and rubber from the car and truck. Don essentially went through the car. In all actuality, his thigh bone ended up somewhere on the road behind him, his other leg in the engine block of the truck. Don recalls being bathed in a peaceful white light, and where loved ones came to meet him. They were waiting for him next to a large, ornate gate or entryway to a huge garden. And it wasn't a short trip either. Don spent 30 minutes in this place. In the West, most people describe what can be considered heaven after they die. But just like all ancient cultures, everyone interprets their experience based on their personal beliefs, understandings, and background. A Christian will say that he met Jesus in heaven. An atheist will enter something like a bright white ether or peaceful serene tunnel. Muslims will raise to Jannah. Buddhists will be born again into a better existence. But what's universal is that while there is always something or someone with us. Emery was a first-year law student who liked fast cars. After lying to both her parents and her boyfriend about what she was doing one evening, she went out driving with some friends. Whilst out on the drive, she had a sudden urge to go home. She didn't have a reason or know why, but the feeling that she did have inside was really strong, like there was an emergency or something wrong. Her friends agreed to take her home, but on the way, there was an awful accident. Emery's body was thrown through the windshield of the car. She wasn't wearing a seatbelt. Her body landed almost 60 feet down the road. But she got to her feet. She was covered in blood, but miraculously without any pain. She walked over to where the wreck of the car was and could see some of her friends sitting at the side of the road. They were in floods of tears and also very bloody. Emery felt like she had been unconscious for a while and had experienced the strangest dreams. She asked her friends what was happening, what she had missed, but no one would speak. Her friend Blaine in particular was hysterical, with tears and raw emotion. Her parents pulled up in their car a short while later, and even though paramedics tried to stop him, Henry, Emery's father, pushed past them and ran to the smashed car wreck. Emery followed his gaze and realized he was running towards a body laying in the road next to the car. She chased after him. He was on his knees sobbing over the body, cradling its head in his arms. Emery was dead. It was her body, and she was stood over it, over her grieving father. Between his tears, her father said, "Why are you doing this?" And out of nowhere, a voice replied, "This was the agreement that we had." But Emery's father replied, "No, it wasn't our agreement at all. Please, please don't do this. The agreement was that I would watch them grow old, but never live to experience them go." Emery knew her father wasn't having this conversation out loud. It was happening in his subconscious. He didn't even know he was speaking. It was his soul speaking to someone. Well, someone other. The voice started to disappear into a place she couldn't quite hear, but Emery knew it was there. She tried to follow the sound, but couldn't. The voice was so calming and peaceful, but her world was slowly fading. The next memory she has was waking up in the hospital critical care unit. Tens of thousands of people have reported to have had near-death experiences. The experiences crossed countries, cultures, and time periods. You can get lost for hours reading about them online. They each sound serene, life-altering, and usually in a very good way.
I'm Don Piper, and I died on January 18th, 1989. I was depressed for a long time after I came back to life, but in time I realized just how valuable dying had been to me and to my soul. I felt saved. Now I take comfort knowing that God and my family are waiting for me.
But near-death experiences are not a bucket list ticket item that you can just go and experience whenever you like. It's not like the movie Flatliners, or a high that you can pay to experience like taking mind-altering drugs. An NDE, for lack of a better explanation, requires a certain type of permission. This sounds religious and a reference to a higher power, but that's not where I'm going with this. Not everyone has reported going into a light. Some people have said they experienced something else. Somewhere else. Howard Storm, for example, woke up in his hospital bed. This was back in 1985. Howard was a university lecturer. He was in Paris with his wife. He had taken her on what he thought was a romantic holiday, although in all actuality, he had just invited her along on a university field trip with his students. Howard was like this, though. He was going to Paris anyway. Taking his wife along was romantic, right? He thought. Howard didn't really get romance. He wasn't particularly romantic, to say the least. In fact, Howard had always been a pretty difficult man. He was rarely happy, had a quick temper, and very little patience. He was moody and a bit of a grump. In many ways, he took after his father, who was aggressive towards Howard when he was younger. Howard was angry when he woke up in the hospital bed. He was annoyed at his wife for closing the curtains in his hospital room. And why was she sat there crying next to his bed anyway? This wasn't happening to her after all, he thought. She wasn't poorly. A few hours ago, Howard was screaming in agony due to a perforated intestine at the hospital. Howard was told that he needed emergency surgery right away. If he didn't have the surgery, he would be dead within 5 hours. Somehow, however, the hospital lost track of him. He had laid there for almost 10 hours, his body slowly digesting itself. Although he did feel a lot better. Better, but still angry. Healthier, but in a bad mood. He wanted some sunlight and some fresh air. So he got to his feet and walked across the room to open the windows. But something was wrong. His wife completely ignored him. He could feel something radiating off her, though, like an energy or an emotional field that he had never seen or felt before. What does she have to be sad or angry about? Howard kept asking himself. Irrespective, he couldn't deal with her right now, so he walked out into the hallway to find a doctor and give them a piece of his mind. As he turned the corner into the hallway, a sensation hit him. He was never going back into that hospital room. Not ever again. He didn't know how he knew this, but he just did. Then the hallway went dark. Howard could see less and less as the hallway went completely black. Something was blocking the light. As he tried to focus, he saw them. Faceless beings, all black, thin and gaunt. At the sight of them, Howard fell to the ground in fear. Everything felt heavy, the air thinned. He knew who these were, or what they were, even. He knew they were here specifically for him, and their intent was to drag him to hell. Howard was in pure darkness, and he heard a voice say, "We're almost there." Suddenly the darkness lifted and Howard was in a vast hellscape, filled with horrors that his worst nightmares couldn't create. Hell was too faint a phrase to describe the terror that Howard witnessed.
But were you experiencing pain while this was happening?
Yeah, and it was horrible. It was horrible. Literally being torn apart.
Howard, you're watching your life literally as a movie before you?
Absolutely, and not only did I see my life, but I could also see, like, my mother's feelings and how I hurt her. I never wanted to hurt my mother.
Howard said he wanted to stay in this place where he felt nothing but kindness, compassion, and love. But he was told he had to go back and make things right. Then, he said, his soul returned to his body. Very few near-death experiences take place in hell, but those who end up there often follow a similar path and experience, as Howard reported. In the lead-up to death, there is an emotional trauma. Sometimes it's drug abuse, alcoholism, self-abuse, or just being a terrible person, like Howard. People describe being lost, wandering a desolate landscape. They hear endless screams. Some come from creatures that look like they were once human, but are no longer. Descriptions of hell sound similar to the ancient Egyptian process of death. They walk through the Hall of Truths to be judged. Their hearts are weighed and their hearts devoured. If there really is a hell, and described by so many cultures and religions, then that's a terrifying thought. It makes me wonder how heavy my heart will be compared to the feather of Anubis. Skeptics argue that's the point. They say religions and ancient rulers invented the concept of heaven and hell. That religion, and all it encompasses, is a method of mass control and influence, rather than an eternal belief and salvation. Those same skeptics will argue that religion's purpose is to maintain order in societies of thousands of millions of people. And that has to be difficult, right? But if people believe in hell, they'll obey and behave, thus being easier to control. Since the 1907 21 grams experiment by Duncan MacDougall, research in death has been very taboo. Because of this, there are not a great deal of scientific studies that try to explain what happens after we die. But all that would change with the publication of a study in May of 2023. A group of scientists measured and mapped the brain activity of dying patients. They proved that after the body shuts down completely, the brain becomes more active than it was previously. While scientists haven't figured out how our brains work, they do know this much, that the old adage that we as humans only use 10% of our brains, well, while this isn't actually true, a human brain isn't really functioning at full capacity all of the time either. Certain parts are used at specific times while others rest and so on. Essentially, we know what parts of our brain light up when we're engaged in different activities, but we don't know how or why this happens. What energy source forms our thoughts and feelings and memories and reactions? Scientists are still trying to figure this out. Does cell activity produce the mind, or does the mind create cell activity? And what is the human mind exactly? Are minds just another way of describing our souls? Is our soul consciousness? Are they the same thing, or are they separate? And when we die, does our consciousness die too? If so, does our soul live on? Nobody really knows the answer to any of these questions. So in a May 2023 study, a group of scientists published research in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences journal. Dr. Jimo Borijan and her team studied consciousness. They wanted to know, what is the minimum process required to create consciousness in our physical brain? It was a unique and unprecedented study. The research involved four patients who were all in comas and on life support. They were each nearing the end of their lives. These patients were chosen because while they weren't fully brain dead, they were completely unresponsive to any and all stimuli. The study also had the full consent of the patient's family, just to be clear on that. Anyway, there is a scale that medical professionals use to assess a person's level of consciousness following a head injury. It's called the Glasgow Coma Score, named after the city it was derived in. These four patients had the lowest score possible on the Glasgow Coma Score scale. All of them had severe brain injuries and no medical chance of returning to conscious life. Several doctors all agreed on the decisions. With the permission of their families, these four patients' brains were scanned as they were taken off life support while still in a coma. Their brain scans produced the following results. As they were comatose, the patients' brain scans produced low-frequency readouts, which was expected and entirely normal for patients in a coma. These are autonomic motor functions like breathing, heartbeat, and hormone regulation. Basically, the things the body does on its own. Consciousness, on the other hand, occurs at much higher frequencies for the record. When the patients were taken off life support, something strange happened that surprised the scientists. Well, there was a sudden surge in brain activity at higher frequencies for extended periods of time. Remember, the body is now shutting down. Life support has been turned off. The heart and lungs have both stopped, but the brain is lighting up. The readouts were like a Christmas tree. Something was happening to those patients, consistently, that in theory and medically couldn't be happening. About 10 minutes before brain death, there is suddenly more activity across the entire brain frequency spectrum, and then for a few seconds a significant spike. Highly active brain activity, all before the activity eventually settles down again. Whilst it's easy to dismiss this spike as an anomaly, let's say some randomly firing neurons firing off as there's no oxygen getting to the brain anymore, for instance. But then this happens. The patient's entire brain fires off very high readouts across the whole spectrum once again. The patients have been medically dead for 12 to 15 minutes here, but their brains are fully alive and engaging in, well, something. A skeptic might say this is just random neurons desperately clinging to life. But that's not what's happening at all. Not at these frequencies, and not in these parts of the brain. In fact, parts of the brain that were showing significant activity are parts that are used while being very active in life. Specific parts of the patient's brains were active. The scientists saw activity in their somasensory cortex and the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. The somasensory cortex processes information from your senses like touch, pressure, pain, and temperature. This part of the brain even processes proprioception, which senses your body's position. To elaborate, this part of the brain is activated when engaging in physical activities like sports, combat, exercises, and other strenuous tasks. Movements where your body needs to be aware of its position, motion, and balance. It's active when using fine motor skills like writing, typing, drawing, or playing a musical instrument too. These patients are dead, remember, yet their brain is acting like their body is engaged in physical activity. And the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, well, that part of the brain is used for problem solving and decision making. It assesses risk, weighs pros and cons, and considers different outcomes. This is also the part of the brain used for language and communication, and more than just simple communication. The dorsolateral prefrontal cortex is used to construct complex ideas and engage in debate. It's where your analytical skills are processed. These patients' brains, these dead patients' brains, are engaged in highly complicated thought and reasoning, as well as physical motion, after death. But what was this? The brain activity wasn't random. It was organized, and specific scans showed that messages were being sent back and forth to the patient's posterior cerebral cortex. Researchers know that this area of the brain is required for conscious perception, visual and sound processing, understanding spoken language, and integrating sensory information and movement. These patterns are identical to what we see in healthy brains that are dreaming. This is also a pattern similar to epileptics who have an out-of-body experience. Not only were these patients dead, but they died with brain damage, and there was no brain activity before life support was disconnected. None. But after death, their brains lit up like the sky on Guy Fawkes Night. And this was consistent across all of the patients, so not random one-offs. Finally, the brain activity eventually slows, and then about 5 minutes later, it completely stops. But for a short period after death, this previously comatose, brain-damaged, and now medically deceased person had an extremely vivid conscious experience and showed no sign of brain damage at all. This cannot be replicated in life. In their mind, their body was moving, their senses were engaged, they could smell, they could feel and touch. They were seeing and hearing something, and they were having a conversation with someone. Which takes us full circle. The questions the scientists asked here are the same we pondered early on. Who are they talking to? Is there a scientific explanation for near-death experiences, or is something supernatural at work? Near-death experiences are described in the same way in every culture and have been since the beginning of recorded history. Common features include floating above your body, traveling through a tunnel toward a bright light, feelings of serenity, communicating with spirits and seeing long-deceased loved ones. No matter the culture, the religion, or lack of religion, NDEs are a universal human experience. This could be because there is an afterlife and we do have a soul. Or the experiences are similar because our brains are built the same way. The most widely accepted scientific theory is that NDEs are hallucinations that happen as brain cells begin to die from lack of oxygen. This is called the dying brain hypothesis. This could explain why so many NDEs share common supernatural elements. They may be byproducts of the brain's final burst of activity when your brain isn't getting enough oxygen, so you experience tunnel vision as your optic nerves fail. This could be why so many people describe a tunnel too. You see, when astronauts and pilots experience intense acceleration and they go through high levels of G-force, they often report getting tunnel vision and seeing bright lights as their oxygen levels drop. In a dying brain, neurons fire in cascades that could be perceived as bright lights. In fact, this actually happened to Neil Armstrong during his training for the Apollo moon mission. If you were one of those people who experienced panic attacks, you may also have experienced tunnel vision, feeling lightheaded or numbness in your extremities. These effects and nothing more than the brain not getting enough oxygen, which is why taking deep breaths helps during a panic attack or breathing into a paper bag. Lack of oxygen can also cause hallucinations. Like when mountaineers climb huge mountains like Everest in the Himalayas, they now bring oxygen with them, but they didn't always do this. In the 1930s and 40s, climbers on Mount Everest often reported seeing a companion climbing with them, talking to them, and sharing their food with them. But these companions weren't actually there. This is known as third man syndrome. The companions were hallucinations due to lack of oxygen. even though the climbers would all swear these companions were real. See also Guardian Angels and The Abominable Snowman. But let's also talk about temporal lobe epilepsy. It has also been known to cause NDEs. The temporal lobe of the brain is crucial in processing emotion memory, and also involved in the formation of the conscious self. In scientific and medical studies, stimulating this region of the brain has triggered out-of-body experiences similar to those reported in near-death experiences. Then there are chemical changes. Fluctuations in dopamine and serotonin, be that accidental or intentional. These chemicals cause feelings of happiness and peace. In turn, there is a release of endorphins. This also causes a feeling of peace. So peace plus endorphins equal a natural painkiller. It's been suggested that N,N-dimethyltryptamine, or DMT, is released in our brains upon birth and upon death. DMT is a powerful and natural psychedelic. Our bodies produce it. Skeptics say these chemicals likely contribute to the NDEs, dream and sensory-like quality. But, and I will add this personal comment here, a DMT experience is nothing like a near-death experience. Take my word for it and don't ask how I know. But when someone is having a near-death experience, they're very aware of their conscious self. DMT, which is also called the spirit molecule, detaches you from your ego. You feel like you're disconnected from everything and connected to everything all at the same time. It's complicated to explain, but I don't recommend you seek it out or try it. Anyway, let's jump back to Professor McDougall and the weight of the human soul. Scientists proved it weighs 21 grams, right? Well, yes, kind of. The McDougall experiment is true, and the results factual. You can look them up. But the experiment hasn't been successfully replicated since. But not because it can't be. More so that no one has tried. And why not? Well, the answer to that also poses significant thought and weight. If science can prove the existence of the soul, it would be one of the most important discoveries in human history, right? But that discovery would also be extremely dangerous. Culturally, religiously, scientifically. The fact scientists won't repeat McDougall's 21-gram experiment doesn't surprise me in the slightest. In fact, did you know that when McDougall was conducting his study, the owners of the nursing home where he exercised the research were worried the church would find out and be furious with them? When his results were released, the opposite actually happened. It was scientists who were furious and not the church. The church was actually thrilled with the outcome and even announced the research and results. McDougall had proven the existence of a soul, after all. He was only a step away from proving the existence of God. But to this day, many scientists dismiss McDougall's study and results, calling them utterly false. But they aren't. And if they were, then they should be able to prove it, right? But no one is willing to do so. Whilst many of McDougall's peers call the study unscientific due to the small sample size and the methods used, the outcome remains. Maybe McDougall didn't prove that there is a soul, but no one can or has proven that there isn't one. Science says that when our brains stop working, nothing further happens. We're just dead, endless nothingness. But recent studies, like the one we talked about today, proves there is something happening. Scientists have proven science wrong. Science doesn't have the answer. Religion often says it does. And governments have been trying to destroy religion for the last 150 years. Because if science were to conclusively prove the existence of the human soul, the next step would be to prove the existence of God. That would eliminate the need for the military-industrial complex, for mass control by the state, and the power balance to lean from state over to religion. It would eliminate the need for a militarized police force. We would finally know what our purpose in life was. The meaning of life, isn't that one of, if not the biggest question that we all have? Are we to be virtuous, good, kind, generous, and help our fellow humans navigate life and the world? If we knew for certain where we were going and what the certainty was if we didn't follow the rules well enough, you'd see a pretty big drop in all crime, right? Any dictators and world rulers would think twice before seizing power. How could they seize power? They wouldn't be able to amass their armies, followers, or enough people willing to go against their certain finality. There is no scientific proof of a soul and an afterlife. But there is evidence, mounting evidence. But that isn't proof just yet. If you're a person of faith, you don't need proof. You already know there is a God and heaven awaits you. But what about those of us who aren't religious? I consider myself very practical. I would love scientific proof of an afterlife, but what I find very strange is that I don't really need it. I have a sense deep down that there is something more. I think most of us do, but maybe that's just the way we have evolved. I'm not a religious person. I'm entirely atheist. But that doesn't mean that I don't wonder if there is more out there, more after this. We are all aware that our own death is inevitable, and we all have a built-in natural mechanism to keep us from worrying about death. It tells us not to dwell and stress about the inevitable, and that everything is going to be okay. I'm glad that mechanism is there, but I find it interesting that we all have one in the first place. I'm not suggesting intelligent design, but it's certainly an interesting product of evolution. Recent studies have shown that when a person dies, their cells don't start decaying immediately. They remain in a state of hibernation for a while. That seems like it has a purpose behind it, does it not? It's as if after death our bodies are exercising the next stage in the process, a natural and consistent process that we can't explain. And maybe we aren't meant to be able to explain it. Good night, everyone.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.